The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h. Word
of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 55 years ago, Harper Lee's novel To Kill a Mockingbird gave the nation a glimpse of the Deep South.
Macon was a tired old town, even in 1932 when I first knew it. There was no hurry, for there was nowhere to go, nothing to buy, no money to buy it with. Although Macon County had recently been told that it had nothing to fear but fear itself. That summer, I was 6 years old.
That's from the 1962 film adaptation of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, a beloved classic that is still read in middle and high schools across the country. While the novel went on to sell 40 million copies, Monroeville, Alabama, the town that Macon was based on, quietly faded from the public imagination. With Lee's recently discovered manuscript, Ghost Said a Watchman, being published tomorrow, the writer Paul Theroux went down to Monroeville to see the town where Harper Lee and her friend and collaborator Truman Capote grew up, and which now calls itself the literary capital of Alabama. He wrote about his visit for Smithsonian Magazine. And Paul Theroux, what a pleasure to have you on Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you very much, Virginia. It's delightful to be here.
Well, for many people, To Kill a Mockingbird really forms one of the few images they have of a small town in the Deep South. Is the Macon of To Kill a Mockingbird similar to the Monroeville you visited this year?
I think there's a sort of glow about the Macon of the book. Monroeville is like a lot of towns in the South. They're places that were once industrious. They had business, they had manufacturing, they had cotton or some kind of agriculture, and they've lost it either because of NAFTA or just people leaving. So Monroeville, the Macon of the novel, is rather sad, out of work, and it's sort of a shadow of its former self. You know, after this terrible crime in the book, as it's described, set in the 1930s, there were several other crimes there, you know, racial crimes, which were just as bad. So the book didn't enlighten anyone or cure anyone of their bigotry or the injustice that was going on there.
Well, the town is trying to capitalize on its relationship to the book and the movie and as home to Truman Capote and to Harper Lee, who still does live there. Well, first, what did you learn about these two famous residents from townsfolk who remembered them?
What you find, it's very interesting. This is also true of the South in general, which is that writers in the South tend to make a reputation by leaving the South. There are a couple of exceptions. Flannery O'Connor is an exception. William Faulkner is an exception. There are a few others. But most Southern writers became famous or established themselves as writers by leaving. And when Harper Lee, or Nell, they call her down there, she went to New York City. She wanted to write a novel. She's had a very odd career. Truman Capote the same. They grew up as neighbors. Harper Lee was Truman Capote's defender. He was kind of a whale, wimpy thing, and she was pretty tough. But the town is very proud of them, but the town didn't nurture them, and any more than, you know, other towns in the South nurtured their writers. They come to New York, they go to Boston, go to New Hampshire for that matter, and the Southern writer makes a reputation. Barry Hanna, who's a Southern writer from Mississippi, said that he got most of his writing done by living in Vermont in the snow. So the fact that the book is set there and Ghost Set a Watchman is set in Monroeville means that people go there on literary pilgrimages and they look for the remnants of the town. And actually, because the town is so poor, the remnants of the town still exist. There's still the courthouse, still the stores, there's still the old, you know, hardware store, the old jail, the black part of town, the wealthy white part of town, the golf course, and 24 churches that are all bustling and busy on Sunday. So no one's disappointed when they go to Monroeville. They see it and they say, this is just what I was expecting to find.
But yet some of the residents that you spoke to kind of rolled their eyes when the novel was mentioned. Why?
Black residents roll their eyes because they say very little has changed. White residents don't roll their eyes. They're kind of pleased and proud. Black residents have had a tough time there. They're still somewhat sidelined, and their story hasn't been told. And certainly, Harper Lee didn't tell their story. After she wrote that book, she didn't write anything else. Hers is one of the oddest literary careers in the books. So she wrote the book. She's got those two books, the old one that's coming out now, and To Kill a Mockingbird. And then she just, you know, she was only in her 30s, and she just stopped. She was making a ton of money, but, I mean, she didn't do what I was doing, which is, you know, go to a place and write about it and write for a magazine. And I've written, you know, with no boast, but I've written about 50 books in my life. So she hasn't done that. Nothing against her. It's just something I don't understand and would like to understand. But no one can ask her. No one talks to her. She doesn't give interviews. So we'll never know the reason.
Well, the book, of course, was set in the 1930s in the Jim Crow South. You met a number of people who remembered living there at that time. And you just alluded to that's not officially segregated today, but there are some pretty distinct color lines for the people of Monroeville. Where do those begin and end?
People have long memories there, and there's memories of where people live and where they don't live. Actually, the color line isn't strict in Monroe. You know, the traditionally white part of town has plenty of black residents. The black part of town doesn't have any white residents. Where you find segregation in the South is in churches, barbershops, and funeral parlors. You never find a white person in a black funeral parlor or a white person in a black barbershop or vice versa. But it's not so much the segregation because people tend to self-segregate. The odd thing was how little had changed in terms of justice. In the 1980s, there was a miscarriage of justice that was just like To Kill a Mockingbird, where a man who was completely innocent, black man, was found guilty of killing a white woman, and he was put on death row. And he was gone off on an innocence project. There was no evidence to support it. But this was in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the book by then had been a long bestseller, and people thought, oh, well, everything's fine. But one of the curious things about the South is that things aren't fine, and I think you notice that, this controversy about the Confederate flag.
Right.
If you go to Selma, for example, Selma is a wonderful example of voters' rights and the will of people. But if you go to Selma today, you'll see a place that really there's no work, it's very sad, businesses are closed, and it's a symbol of something, but there's not a lot happening. The South may not rise again, but the South is a very sad and bewildered place.
We're talking with the writer and novelist Paul Theroux about his visit to Monroeville, Alabama. That's the town fictionalized as Macomb in Harper Lee's famous novel, To Kill a Mockingbird, and the new novel, Go Set a Watchman, which is coming out tomorrow. Well, you make the point that the kind of dramatic weirdness that has traditionally been played up in the Southern fiction of Faulkner or Flannery O'Connor or Erskine Caldwell, and even today's fiction, looks backwards rather than the aspects of contemporary Southern life. Well, what's going on there?
I think that what it is, it's sort of indirection. It's people satirizing themselves by exaggerating the freakishness of their society and not looking at the ordinary facts of the society, the realities of it. The realities are really almost too sad to contemplate. So it's made into a kind of carnival, kind of freak show, a sort of circus, and with grotesque characters. And that's the way Southern fiction has sort of managed. And this is also why, if you go from New Hampshire to Mississippi, you'll find something that you hadn't expected to find. The Mississippi and Alabama that's described in the books doesn't exist. You go there and you'd find a completely different place, a more interesting place, a sadder place, but a less highly colored place. Mainly, you find places that are out of work. There's no work. And when people don't have any work, when they have no money, when they're entirely dependent on government handouts, welfare, or living, you know, poorly, they're living a completely different kind of life. It's not colorful. It's just rather sad.
But even under this long shadow of racial injustice and places that you're describing as being completely left behind economically, the Deep South, it's still a draw for those nostalgic for, you know, the sleepy southern towns where the humidity is thick and the tea is sweet. Are these the sort of paradoxes maybe unique to the South?
Yes, I haven't. I feel as if I've been negative talking to you. The South has so many virtues. People really are friendly, black and white, very friendly. Friendly to strangers, friendly to each other. There's no question about that. They have a sense of the past. They have a strong sense of their history. They have a lot of pride in their culture, in their cooking, in the way of speaking. So much has been taken from them, and they feel very belittled and mocked. They feel they've lost everything. They lost the Civil War. The Civil Rights Movement was a kind of war. People are trying to take things away from them. Now, you know, rightly or wrongly, they want to take guns away. They want to take the flag away. They want to take, you know, the memory of their struggle away. So I'm not saying that they are right, but you can kind of identify with their sense of feeling weakened by outside forces, mm-hmm. just the way they did through history. But the federal government, Washington's trying to tell them what to do. And it's not that they all want to be slave owners. They want their identity. And I'm speaking of both of blacks and whites, that Southern identity really cuts across that.
Well, one of the many characters that you write about and meet in your trip, Sam Williams, he was once a traveling lingerie salesman, and he urged you, talk nice about Monroeville. What would he think of your portrait of that town?
I was so struck by this man. I was asking him questions about the past, about the trial, about the book. His business had closed. This man was a traveling salesman for a lingerie manufacturer that at its peak hired oil employed 2,500 people in Monroeville. Uh-huh. Now it's gone, and those 2,500 people are unemployed. Mm. Then he became conscious of the fact that he was being kind of downbeat, and then he said to me, when you leave, talk nice about us. Don't run us down. And I don't want to run them down. I don't think that they did it to themselves. The South in general lost its industry because of companies leaving. They went to Mexico, they went to China, they went to India, they went to Vietnam. They left them, and they left the people unemployed. You know, agriculture became mechanized. So there's mass unemployment, and that's not a great thing. It's really hurt the South, and they feel damaged as a result.
How about this new book, Go Set a Watchman? Are you looking forward to reading it?
I'm looking forward to reading it, but I don't have high hopes. You may have gathered from what I wrote in Smithsonian that I'm not a great fan of To Kill a Mockingbird. I think that Flannery O'Connor is right. It's a child's book. Mm. It's an oversimple book. And the writing is very odd. It reads very much like an early effort at writing. If you write for a long time, over a period of time, I mean, I'm way past retirement age. I've written, you know, every day of my life I write something. Your writing does change and it improves. But Harper Lee's writing is frozen in time, and her views are frozen in time. So I don't have high hopes, but as an artifact, as a piece of history, I'm very, very curious to read it.
Well, Paul Theroux, a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Virginia. It's a pleasure to speak to you.
Paul Theroux is a journalist, travel writer, and novelist. His upcoming book is called Deep South, Four Seasons on Back Roads. And you can find a link to read his article, What's Changed and What Hasn't in the Town That Inspired To Kill a Mockingbird. It's in Smithsonian Magazine. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. Also, details there for today's live reading at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord of the entire novel of To Kill a Mockingbird. My colleague Brady Carlson and I will be among those scheduled to read from the book. You can find details, again, at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the 1940s, someone or something was prowling around Mattoon, Illinois, spraying knockout gas into residents' homes in the middle of the night. The mad gasser of Mattoon terrified the town, only he didn't exist. Memory Palace producer Nate DeMeo brings us the incredible story of one of the most peculiar cases of mass hysteria in U.S. history.
The man awoke with a start and threw up. He could barely see. It was just before dawn. He smelled something strange and sweet in the air there in his bedroom. He turned to his wife and asked her to run to the kitchen and make sure that the pilot light in the stove was still on, that there wasn't a gas leak. She went to get up, but found that her legs no longer worked. Later that night, on August 31st, 1944, a young woman across town, her husband off to war, awoke alone in her bed to the sound of her daughter crying and coughing in the next room. She went to get up, but found that her legs no longer worked. The next night, around 11:30, a woman, Mrs. Kearney, was getting ready for bed. She smelled something strange. She walked around her dark house trying to find the source, until her legs started tingling, and she found they no longer worked. She screamed, you would too, and her sister came running in from down the hall. She called the police. When they came, she told them that the strange smell seemed to be coming in through her sister's bedroom window. The police didn't find anything. They left, and left the woman alone. 2 hours later, Mrs. Kearney's husband, Bert, pulled into the driveway after his shift as a taxi driver. There, beneath his bedroom window, while his wife slept just inside, was a strange figure dressed in black, crouching in the darkness. Bert would later tell the police that the figure, tall and thin, ran off into the woods and vanished. The good people of Mattoon, Illinois, were terrified. Over the course of several nights, 21 of them were awoken, those who were able to sleep at all, with the smell of gas coming through the window, or to find that they were unable to move, or to find the strange man in black standing, looking at them through their windows, before disappearing into the night. The police would come, and there'd be nothing, no footprints, nothing at all, but still the strange man in black kept coming. The police added officers to the late shift. The FBI was brought in from Springfield. Citizen patrols took to the streets with flashlights and guns, trying to catch the strange man in black. But they didn't, and he kept coming, terrorizing people in the night. A few times he left little clues, a torn screen, some trampled brush. Beulah Cordes of North 21st Street came home late one night to find a white piece of cloth on her porch. She picked it up and smelled it, and doubled over, vomiting and screaming that her mouth and her throat were burning. When the cops arrived and ran tests on the cloth, they determined that whatever caused Mrs. Cordes to become sick had vanished from the cloth, like the strange man in the night. And then it was over. The strange man in black was gone, as mysteriously as he had arrived. And when he was gone, some people said he wasn't a man at all, that he was something other, something from beyond this world. Even today, the people of Mattoon say that sometimes in early fall, as they lie awake in the dark, they can hear him tapping at their windows. Nah, they don't. Although, having been to Mattoon, it might give them something to do. I think they don't, anyway. I haven't done like a poll or anything, but they shouldn't, because the man in black, the man the papers called the Mad Gasser of Mattoon, or the anesthetic prowler, or my favorite, the phantom anesthetist, probably didn't exist. And I don't mean that in a ghost don't exist sort of way. I mean, there probably wasn't even a creepy weirdo running around town, or a guy with a spray can trying to knock people out to break in and steal their stuff. The strange smell, the vomiting, the burning lips and throats may have been caused by some pre-EPA, pre-Clean Air Act emissions from a couple of industrial plants nearby. That's what the chief of police declared shortly after the frantic call stopped coming into his station. But eventually, opinion coalesced around another theory. The Mad Gasser of Mattoon was a case of mass hysteria. Those first attacks were all in the victims' heads. And then the idea of the attacks got into everyone's heads. A psychologist first put the theory forward a few years later in the early 50s. And though his reason for it, that the women were hysterical because their men were off fighting World War II, sort of icky and sexist, his mass hysteria theory has held up. Meaning the good people of Mattoon, Illinois, in late summer, early fall, 1944, joined the people of Strasbourg, Germany, who danced uncontrollably for days on end in 1518. The nuns who couldn't stop screaming and squirming at a convent in Würzburg, Germany in 1749. The other nuns who would meow for several hours a day in Austria later that century. The students at a mission school near Lake Tanganyika who started laughing one afternoon in 1963 and couldn't stop. And then their laughter spread throughout the surrounding villages. Or the 600 girls at an all-girls school in Mexico who in 2006 became paralyzed and nauseous. Just like the people of Mattoon, after the strange man in black came in the night. The strange man in black who didn't exist at all. Or did he? Nah, I'm just screwing, he totally didn't.
And that was producer Nate DeMeo, creator of the podcast The Memory Palace. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Much like a cunning bank heist, there's something undeniably fascinating about art frauds and forgeries. Perhaps because we're bombarded with stories of incompetent, violent crimes, it's the skill, the planning, and the access required to carefully dupe the art world that easily captivates the public imagination. Anthony Amore is chief investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston and author of Stealing Rembrandts and, more recently, The Art of the Con, the most notorious fakes, frauds, and forgeries in the art world. Amore explores the rise and fall of a great many master forgers, from the devious to the delusional, including Wolfgang Beltracchi, whom he says may be the very best of them all. And Anthony, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Virginia.
So what stands out about Beltracchi's forgeries? Now, this is compared to other famous copyists and frauds throughout history. What makes him so memorable?
Wow. The Beltracchi case is one that the people who've heard about it or read about it are just taken with. First of all, even though he wasn't known to the people who bought the paintings, he was doing the forgeries behind the scenes. Once he was exposed as the artist of the true artist of these Kempendonck paintings and Max Ernst, etc., he is such an engaging character. He looks like what you would envision an art forger to look like. He has this impish way about him. He speaks with this German accent, but in a way that's sort of endearing, and I think he captures the imagination of people who like to romanticize the idea of these art criminals.
What was his technique?
It's really a fascinating story. You know, my entire book, just to backtrack for a second, is about really the people who buy these paintings, who acquire these forgeries. I think my hypothesis is that they are more victims of the elaborate story behind the paintings than the art itself. So Wolfgang Beltracchi had this scam that he pulled with his wife, Helene, and they created provenance for paintings he painted in the style of certain abstract expressionists. So, for instance, he would imagine a painting by Max Ernst, and he would execute it, and he would do a reasonably good job. I wouldn't know it from the real Max Ernst sorts of works. But the real trick to selling these was his ability to create provenance for these paintings. So when his wife would bring them to art dealers and say, I have this Max Ernst painting, and the dealer would say, where did you get it? She had this incredibly elaborate story about her father and said that these paintings belonged to her father, who hid them from the Nazis. And she inherited them from him after his death, and she was producing this new collection to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this provenance that tricked the dealers and a believing public.
They even took photographs and sort of artificially aged them so it would look like her grandmother sitting in the salon with all of these pictures in the background.
Unbelievable. Wolfgang went out and bought a period camera from her grandmother's time and the period paper, and took pictures of his wife dressed as her own grandmother in front of these forgeries and used that as provenance.
We've introduced so many things. First of all, provenance is the art world term for origins, I guess, and the history of how it changed hands from person to person. Have I got that right?
You do, and what makes it difficult in the art world is that there's no set form for provenance. It's not like a birth certificate. Well, it's issued by the state, and this is what it should look like, et cetera. There's provenance can come in many different forms, including a photo of your family member from the time.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing about Beltracchi that I think is so daring and interesting is that he wasn't just copying known existing works. He was, as you say, kind of imagining, he was creating new work as if by these artists.
Exactly correct. He would imagine a Campendonk painting and imagine what he would have created and gone, and he went and made them. And again, to the layman or even to the novice collector, they're easily passable. But what you find with Beltracchi is that even the experienced collectors and dealers were buying into the story based on the strength of this provenance. Beltracchi even went as far as to create fake labels, aged labels, to put in the back of paintings, showing that they came from a Nazi-era art dealer in Germany. So the dealers didn't have to suspend disbelief. He provided all of the provenance for them, but maybe in many cases, lazy legwork led to the sale of millions of dollars worth of these paintings.
How much did his forgery sell for?
They would sell for it, typically in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, but in the high numbers. I mean, Steve Martin, the actor, paid, I believe it was $600,000 for one of these paintings and later had to sell it at a great loss.
How were his works finally detected as frauds?
Well, eventually, one of his paintings was examined by a gentleman named Dr. Nicholas Eastaw in London, and he has a company called Art Access and Research. And Nick Eastaw is an amazing, he's not just a scientist who can use these elaborate tools that I can't even pronounce to examine the science behind art, but he's also a conservator, so he can look at art from an art history and technique perspective. And when he examined these paintings, and I interviewed him, and he told me that technically these were not great forgeries. They were easy to detect. But one of the things he found was in a certain Campendonk painting, a paint was used called titanium white.
Mm-hmm.
And that was shown through the chemical analysis. And Dr. Eastaw was able to show that titanium white did not exist in the time of Campendonk. That was not a color that would have been available to the actual artist, so he showed it would have to have been made after the fact. But you can see it was just this one pigment. Other than that, how would the buyer know? Well, that's titanium white. That's not the correct white from the period. So it took scientific analysis, and what I believe Dr. Eastaw was able to show, and he claims, and I agree, is that many of these forgeries are not difficult to discern using science and using the expertise that he has.
I'm speaking with Anthony Amore. He's chief investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston and author of The Art of the Con, the most notorious fakes, frauds, and forgeries in the art world. And we're talking about one of the forgers he writes about in his book, Wolfgang Beltracchi, who did more than simply copy famous works. He actually created new paintings in the style of well-known modernists and made millions before eventually being caught. I want to talk about the science in just a moment, but first, just to get a larger sense of Wolfgang Beltracchi, he was interviewed for a British news program last year. Here's a clip. Now, he's talking about the painting that got him caught. Now, this is a forgery in the style of the modernist painter, Henrik Campendonk, titled Red Picture with Horses.
That was the most expensive Campendonk ever sold, nearly 3 million euros.
Except it wasn't a Campendonk.
Yeah, it was not a Campendonk. It was for me, sure. Hmm. Oh, it was the best one.
Do you mean the best one of yours?
The best Campendonk.
Is that what you think? You think that your Campendonk was the best Campendonk?
Yeah, that's a little bit difficult. Oh, it was sold as the best Campendonk was ever sold.
Yeah, but was it the best Campendonk?
Yeah, sure.
So fascinating. What does that little clip tell us about the psychology of Beltracchi and maybe even larger of forgers in general? I mean, you got to be pretty confident to be a con artist.
You do, and there's no question these guys are talented. I mean, he's a talented artist. I remember reading how he had said if the artist that he was channeling was left-handed, he would paint with his left hand.
Wow.
And, you know, I wonder if that's true, but I wouldn't put it past him. You can see from that clip, he is sort of an endearing guy. He's hard not to like.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't seem as much as ego as he almost seems wide-eyed when he says that. But what it tells us is that people affix dollar values to art, and once you have a number attached to it, you associate it with greatness, when that might not be the case. You know, the whole idea of art, the beauty being in the eye of the beholder, kind of gets lost in this. Even in when I walk around a museum with people and give them a tour here or there, when I point out a great painting, they'll say to me, "How much is it worth?" As if saying that it's $50 million instead of $500,000 makes it a nicer painting.
Hmm.
And I think that's a commentary, and you could make an argument for that, actually. But there's no question, especially in 2015, that people associate dollar figures with greatness.
Beltracchi was sentenced to 6 years in prison in 2011. But, you know, similar to what you were talking about earlier, the idea that the art world assigns value to things, he got a little bit of a public following there. What do you think of the public regard for, or sort of cheering on in some way, of con men and forgers? What does that say about how the art world is perceived? Like, we're cheering on the guy who hoodwinked them.
It's an excellent point. You know, when the entire book, The Art of the Con, deals mainly with modern paintings, abstract expressionists, et cetera. And I think for the common person out there, they look at some of these paintings and they say, you know, I could do that, or my kid could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they see, well, that painting went for $115 million, and it just boggles the mind. So I think, for the layperson, when they hear that someone like Wolfgang Beltracchi was able to rip off the guy who spent $1 million on one of his forgeries, there's sort of a Robin Hood sort of attitude, like, oh, well, you know, he took money from a willing dupe.
Yeah.
Who was buying something silly anyway. So it doesn't seem like as much of a crime. It obviously there's a victim, but it seems maybe to some that it's victimless because what the money was going to be spent on was silly anyway.
Mm. How does the art world view his forgeries? You know, are they still in circulation?
You know, he's still working with authorities to identify some of his other paintings that are in circulation. After he was convicted, a list of, I want to say, 15 more were released.
Hmm.
And it's believed that there is still, you know, more than a dozen out there. So we may never know. And I think it might be subject to the whims of Wolfgang Beltracchi as to whether he tells.
Well, in your book, you put a lot of faith in the ways that science can expose frauds and forgeries now, the kind, you know, just analyzing the paint, for example, that you mentioned earlier. Do you think it's maybe dangerous to be overconfident about the ability of science to discern and beat the bad guys?
I don't know if it's dangerous. I think the problem is more with people who don't bother to use the services that these analysts can provide. We have one in New England named Jamie Martin, who is an extraordinarily talented person as well in identifying these frauds. Now, I mean, the greater question is it an exact science? And no, but I think it's as near as you can get. And I would say this, if I was going to spend $100 million on a painting, I would certainly spend the thousands of dollars it would take to have, say, Dr. Eastor or his associate, Jalene Nadalny, I would pay them to look at it before I made that sort of investment.
Well, you're chief investigator for a museum. You have a lot more access and probably money to do that kind of forensic work, more so than an individual dealer or curator or a gallerist, don't you?
I think when we're talking about someone that's going to, in the book, we're talking about individuals, investors. And I do think that if you're going to invest that much money into something, I think it makes sense to test its bona fides. And again, relative cost is extremely low.
Well, given your work at the Gardner Museum, where this notorious heist took place in 1990, and looking at the kind of way that forensics experts can look at forgeries, could either of those things happen in the art world again, a heist on that scale, or a forgery on the scale of Beltracchi and others that you write about in the book?
I'm sad to say they could. I mean, I'm happy to say that it wouldn't happen at the Gardner again. But I can tell you that art theft happens every day. And just a couple of years ago, there was a massive theft at the Kunsthal Museum. And if you know, if your listeners Google art theft every week, they're going to see more heist. It's a $6 to $8 billion per year illicit industry, stolen art. In terms of forgeries, the way I end my book with an epilogue of, as I was finishing the book, these were the stories that were in the news just in the last couple of days. And there were more forgeries, more fakes, more scams. And it's something that will never go away, but we can be more vigilant.
How much time do you spend thinking about that heist and especially the fate of those paintings?
Virginia, it's all of my waking moments and most of my sleeping.
Really?
and I can speak for my colleagues in the FBI, it's a complete, absolute, undying obsession with recovering these paintings, which we will one day.
Anthony Amore, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Anthony Amore, he's chief investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, also author of Stealing Rembrandts and more recently, The Art of the Con, the most notorious fakes, frauds, and forgeries in the art world. And you can read more about his work and find a link to hear that full interview with Wolfgang Beltracchi. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When it comes to guiding patrons and tour groups, most museums supplement their professional staff with volunteer docents. The number of arts-loving baby boomers now volunteering at museums is expected to grow more than 20% in the next 5 years. Sounds like a win-win, right? Well, sometimes the free help is not so helpful. The guides go rogue, improvising tours, ignoring rules, touching priceless works, and relaying incorrect information. Ellen Gammerman wrote about docents gone wild for the Wall Street Journal. And Ellen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So are most museum docents in this boomer demographic?
Many of them are, for the simple reason that they have the time, if they're in the boomer demographic that has actually retired. But museums are trying to sort of rebrand themselves in many cases, attract a younger crowd, a more diverse crowd. And part of that means trying to bring in more younger tour guides and change their programs, but the baby boomers are well represented in this group for sure.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the more memorable stories you've heard of unhinged docents?
Okay, well, I should preface all of it by saying to all the docents out there that for every story that I have about docents becoming unhinged, there are many examples of very dedicated, professional people doing this free work for museums that rely on them for this essential service. But having said that, I was at a conference of museum professionals in April, and one of the panels was called Waking Up from Volunteer Nightmares. And there in this conference room at 8:30 in the morning, it was packed. There were stories of bickering spouses, problems with touching the art, as you mentioned.
You actually also heard some stories of people giving false information about the artwork?
Well, yeah, and this is something that if you talk to enough volunteer supervisors, they will tell you happens all the time. The U.S. Midway Museum in San Diego, which has a very robust volunteer corps, they send out what they call the bum dope report every so often, and it just lists the bloopers that they've heard around the ship from different docents, and then you find out what was said, you find out what you should say. I have heard from a lot of museum goers who have said when they've approached their docent and after a tour and gently said, you know, actually that thing you said is wrong, they haven't always felt so comfortable kind of confronting the docent who feels pretty confident in their study and in their information. There was this one case I spoke with a tourist. She had visited the old exchange and provost dungeon in Charleston, South Carolina, and her colonial docent went off script, started improvising, and said, well, I'm going to tell you this, and I just made it up, but it could be true. And she looked at her friends and just couldn't believe what she'd heard and thought, I just paid for that?
So docents just kind of overstepping their bounds, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, one volunteer manager I spoke with at the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington, you know, she said that there's this culture of resistance, and they've been really trying to change their program, and she felt that some of the volunteers had felt that after spending enough time there, they felt entitled and they didn't want to make changes from the way they had previously done things. So when the Hirshhorn changed its program, tried to bring in more college-age students, and some of the volunteers who had been giving tours at the Hirshhorn for longer than their managers probably had been alive, mm-hmm. you know, in some of these cases decades, you know, they felt very disrespected and insulted and forced out.
Well, what does it take to become a tour guide or a volunteer docent? Is it a competitive thing at museums?
It can be. At some of the big city museums, it can be quite a status symbol and quite competitive. You can apply and not even get into the training. You know, at the Whitney Museum in New York, they get more than 100 applications for what ends up being about 30 slots in the training. And over the course of months and months and months of training, 10 people may drop out. So the graduating class is about 20 people who have studied and learned about gesturing and eye contact. It's not just sort of the art history side of it, but they're also learning about body language and how to engage a crowd. So a lot of people take it quite seriously, and a lot of museums take it very seriously.
Okay, so are there any real success stories when it comes to that docent-museum relationship?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're all over. And like I said, they are kind of a lifeblood of many of these museums that need the staff and can't afford them. I spoke with people at military museums where a lot of the volunteers are veterans, and some of the people who are giving the tours have incredible backstories, you know, the experiences that they've had as combat veterans or prisoners of war or what have you. So there's a lot that these docents and tour guides and volunteers may find they have in common with each other. And those experiences can really enrich a tour if you're on a warship and the person you're talking to was a prisoner of war, let's say, in Vietnam, which is the case on the Midway Museum. You know, you can have quite a conversation there.
Mm. I wonder if it was tough for you, Ellen, to get museum personnel to go on record about docents. It could disturb that relationship quite a bit if they were heard to be complaining about their docents.
Yeah, because you just can't. I mean, in a lot of cases, a volunteer might be the wife of a huge contributor, or just, you know, just a very nice person who has worked there for years, and just whatever. You don't want to insult the people who are working right next to you. But at the same time, you know, there's mounting frustration. One museum staffer described it on the record as mutiny on the bounty. You know, and you know, they're trying to rein in people who don't necessarily feel like being told what to do.
Well, Ellen, a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ellen Gammerman, she covers arts and entertainment for the Wall Street Journal. That's where we found her article, Docents Gone Wild. And you can find a link to read it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today, and there's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. If you missed any of the show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. Virginia Prescott will be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.